Dr. Kelsey, since you spoke first, how about getting us started? Read one of those and then answer it. And we'll answer all the questions and read them off from here so that it can be picked up on the recordings and also you can hear.
Try to be as brief as we can, and yes, answer. Not always after it's over, we remember we left something unsaid and unclarified. If Paul's acceptance of police protection is a modification of the Lord's absolute of Matthew 5, then the absolute is no absolute at all. Correct. Jesus did not mean for it to be an absolute. But how would we have known that it wasn't if Paul hadn't told us?
Oh, you were going to answer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is that an answer?
Okay, fine. I was reading.
What?
I was reading. Brother Floyd?
Could dadulotai in verse 15 refer to Paul's restriction, remain unmarried, or be reconciled? In other words, couldn't he be saying, you are not bound to my restriction to remain unmarried or be reconciled? In verse 11, Paul had said that the woman who departs is to remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And so this question is saying, in verse 15, couldn't the phrase, is not bound, couldn't that be referring to verse 11? Therefore, it would mean this, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. The brother or sister is not bound then to remain unmarried or be reconciled to their former partner in such cases. And so freeing them to remarry. I don't believe it could be referring to that. Dadulotai doesn't really mean bound. It means to be enslaved, a far stronger term than bound. And this would not, in my judgment, it would not do justice to the meaning of this word. It seems to me it has to mean more than this provision I've set out in verse 11 is doesn't hold. The brother or sister is not bound. It would be, please pardon me for saying this. Sometimes I want to say this to my students sometime, and I always feel reluctant to say it. I want to tell them often when they suggest an interpretation that it is far-fetched and that you're just reaching out into thin air to get it. Really and truly, I think that this would not suggest itself to a person reading the text, and it is not a legitimate understanding. That is my best judgment of it.
I thought as Brother Kelsey walked off there a minute ago, he was going to say something else, and he didn't, so I asked that. Brother Floyd, if the bondage of 1 Corinthians 7:15 is one to which the believer has never been bound, how is it the believer is released from it only in case the unbeliever departs?
Thank you very much. I need to read that one again. If the bondage of 1 Corinthians 7:15 is one to which the believer has never been bound, how is it that the believer is released from it only in case the believer departs? Oh, I see. It's a little clearer to me now. Well, I was reading a commentary which suggested that ou dedulotai should be understood in this way. The brother or sister has been under bondage, but is not so anymore. And I was reacting to that. I think that is not correct. There is no reason to say that, to take that view of it. It is a perfect tense, and the perfect tense means that an action is completed in the past and that there is a present reality or present result that flows out of the past action. And so he is saying the brother or sister has not been bound and is not now, has not been under bondage, put subjected to such bondage and is not now. It is a very emphatic way of saying the Christian is not obligated to give up his Christian faith in order to remain with the unbeliever. If the unbeliever tries to put that kind of pressure upon him, that would be abject slavery, and the Christian is to reject that.
Okay, another one here. If a woman withholds herself from her husband for months or even years in violation of 1 Corinthians 7 until a man in weakness commits the sin of adultery, is she free to remarry while he is not? Whoever wants it, I guess. Okay.
No.
Okay. His answer was no for the tape over here. Okay. Brother Floyd, if you want to say anything here, feel free to do it. Is there a distinction to be made between those who improperly divorce and remarry in total ignorance of God's teaching and those who improperly divorce and remarry with knowledge of God's teaching?
I dreamed the other night that I was taking my oral examination again. And the questions, I was doing fine for a while. And then the questions began to get harder, and as I began to be cross-questioned, and I got very worried. And I asked a friend of mine what he thought that dream might mean. And he said, I think maybe it refers to the day. I think it is always true. It is a principle of Scripture that the more a person knows of the will of God, the more responsibility he has. Jesus said that the slave who knew his master's will and refused to do it would be beaten with many stripes. And the slave who did not know his master's will and did things deserving of stripes would be beaten with few stripes. And I think he enunciated that principle again and again. It would be more tolerable, he said, for Sodom and Gomorrah than for you, he said, the people of this generation. And the reason you've had greater opportunities than those people had. I think it is a principle. Now, I don't know how to carry that on out and answer all the implications of that, but I think that's a principle. I think I would have to grant that, yes.
Okay, fine. As adultery of Matthew 19:9, a single act, it seems to me this is a very vital question, or a continuous act. And why? And what then does repentance of this sin involve? Continuous act committeth adultery, or is it a one-time sin?
Your verb markatai is present. Whosoever shall put away his wife, marry another, commits adultery. Present tense. Question is that, what kind of present is that? Single act, is it punctiliar or durative, linear? I'll say before I answer the question that in my way of thinking, a person who enters an illegal marriage, an unscriptural marriage, does continue to commit adultery. But there's nothing in the verb, present tense verb, that'll give anybody any consolation on either side of that question. If it gives anybody any support, it would be the punctiliar. It's like I say, whosoever shall aim the gun and pull the trigger commits murder. That doesn't mean keeps on committing murder, does it? Just means commits murder by doing that. So I'd say this, there's not a great deal to be had on the tense of that verb, Matthew 19. It could be iterative, it could be customary, it could be aoristic, it could be futuristic, it could be durative. And it might be gnomic, stating a timeless truth. Okay, that's about all I can say on that.
Would you care to comment on that, Bill Floyd?
Oh, I would agree with Brother Kelsey. I think that is right.
The second part of that question was, what then does repentance of this sin involve? In other words, does it mean that they have to break up or not? I guess is what the implication here is.
Now, you may have in mind a certain couple. I would have to talk to that couple. Can't give an answer. They'll just go out here all over the United States and solve all these. I want to talk to every couple. I don't want to send some answer by way of someone else. Too many details that enter in. Too many things that don't usually come out. And probing, too many things that are vital that even this couple never did see were vital. You can't give a blanket answer.
Okay, Brother Floyd, do you want to comment there? Okay.
You said he agreed, am I correct?
Okay. Oh, here's another one on Matthew 19:9, tying it in with 1 Corinthians 7. How do you reconcile the fact that a person is not under slavery to remain married in 1 Corinthians 7:15 with the fact that there is one accepted reason in Matthew 19:9? Brother Floyd, you hit on that a little bit a while ago. Do you want to comment on that? Like, is there one reason or two reasons?
How do you reconcile the fact that a person is not under slavery to remain married in 1 Corinthians 7:15 with the fact that there is one accepted reason in Matthew 19:9? All right. 1 Corinthians 7:17, Matthew 19:9. 7:15 says, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, not under bondage to preserve the marriage. And how do you reconcile this with the fact that there is one accepted reason for remaining married in Matthew 19:9? Well, this is a problem that the Lord had not dealt with during his ministry. He lived and he worked in Palestine, and he did not ever face the question, what if you have a Jew married to a non-Jew? And so he never had occasion to deal with this question. But the question has to be faced by Paul. And as best I understand it, the question is this: if two pagans marry, one of them becomes a Christian, what if the pagan refuses to live with a Christian? What can the Christian do? What then takes precedence? The Lord had not faced the question. He did not deal with it in Matthew 19. But Paul is dealing with a question which the Lord had never faced in 1 Corinthians 7. What is the Christian to do? Is the Christian to give up his Christianity in order to remain married to the pagan? Paul says that would be slavery to man. And it is unthinkable for a Christian to do it. The answer is no. Now, Matthew 19 says there is one honorable reason for divorce. That is, there may be to one of the parties one honorable reason for divorce, and that is fornication. Otherwise, it is forbidden. And there can be remarriage only on that ground. Paul is not saying there can be remarriage on other grounds. As best I understand it, he is saying simply that the Christian is not under obligation to give up his Christianity to preserve the marriage. If the non-Christian insists upon it, then let him depart. When Jesus was asked about a divorce, what he said in effect was, before we talk about divorce, let's talk about marriage. Let's talk about the meaning of marriage. And the moral meaning of marriage is that there is a covenant in which two people say to each other, I choose you not just for the moment, not just for the day, but for all time and through all change. And they say to each other, what our marriage requires tomorrow, we will choose. And Jesus puts that forward as the moral meaning of marriage. And then, in effect, he's saying to the people, when you understand that, you're not trying to get out of marriage. And I really think that our problem, the horrible problem we have today with divorce, will be solved not when we learn simply what Jesus said about divorce, that he forbade it except on the ground of adultery, but when we learn to accept the Christian worldview, the total Christian worldview, and live on the basis of the Christian worldview in every area of life. And then we will understand that it is possible for a person to bind his will to another through all change. The person who rejects the Christian worldview does not understand that. He thinks it would derogate upon his freedom if he bound his will through all change. And he thinks he can't do it, and all he thinks he can do is, I choose you for this moment, and I will have to renew that choosing every moment. And when I quit renewing that choosing, then it is all over. What I'm saying is, I think to answer this whole question requires It does require us to understand what Jesus said about divorce, but it requires more than that. It requires the total Christian worldview, that it be got into people, so that people then respect what Jesus said, so that people then understand it is possible for a person to bind his will, and so that a person respects the institution of marriage and holds it in honor. At one time, I was interested in the grounds of divorce that Brother Kelsey was giving. At one time, in England, it took a special act of Parliament to get a divorce. Then it was easy for people to remain married because the pressure from all the surrounding culture was against divorce. But now, all the pressure is against keeping the marriage together. And we are told that as the church has to change because the culture is changing. And what we have to do, it seems to me, and what we need to be engaged in doing is to build that Christian consensus so that we can appreciate Christian values. And so we have the Christian understanding of man so that we know we can bind our will to another person in covenant for life. Pardon my long dissertation.
Yes.
Because I disagree with a great deal, Brother Floyd, on 1 Corinthians 7. You okay. Think it ought to be expressed?
Come on up here. Yes, I was thinking on 1 Corinthians 7, Brother Floyd is actually saying that passage is not dealing specifically with divorce and remarriage, right? Okay, Brother Kelsey, you want to give us your view on that?
Well, I would hope, too, that the questions on Matthew 19, that he would have opportunity on those.
Right.
On the 1 Corinthians 7, the brother or sister depart. Now, your word is chorizo. All right, now, that's the same word that's found in Matthew 19 that says, let not man put asunder. In other words, that means a sundering of the marriage. All right, so if the unbeliever departs, unders the marriage, departs, the word doulao, not under bondage, I'll agree that I don't find it used elsewhere of marriage. You don't find any word used very much of marriage. You do find that deo twice, don't you? But as he said, doulao is the stronger verb. And you never find doulao used in any case where a person is not doulao, that isn't free to contract another relationship. If a slave is not doulao, he can go to another master. There's not a great deal to be had there on chorizo or doulao either. I'm just going to read Brother Whiteside on this, and that's my sentiments. I'm sure Brother Floyd and I will still remain good brethren. The verse reads, if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage. In such cases. Now let me turn away from Brother Whiteside. In such cases, they're not under bondage. Now that implies that in other cases, they are under bondage. In other words, if the unbeliever doesn't depart, the brother or sister is enslaved, is under bondage. And whatever kind of bondage it is that the Christian is not under, if the unbeliever chorizo or departs, is the kind of bondage he is under if the unbeliever doesn't depart. Now, if you maintain that this not under bondage means not bound to give up Christ if he leaves, then if he stays, you're under the kind of bondage, which would mean that you are under the kind of bondage to give up Christ. That won't work. This passage seems plain enough, says Brother Whiteside, yet opinions differ. This difference of opinion grows out of the notion that its plain meaning does not seem to harmonize with Matthew 19:9. If a person did not already have his mind made up, he would have no trouble in understanding this verse. Not just about that. It can refer to nothing else than the marriage bond or vow. If either husband or wife becomes a Christian and the other is so bitter against Christianity as to refuse to live with the believer is not under bondage in such cases, is completely released from the marriage vows, and as if no marriage had ever taken place. If this be not so, the believer is still under bondage. But that does not contradict Matthew 19:9 any more than Matthew 19:9 contradicts the original law in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. We usually have argued that is the apostles were the last and final revelators. All that went before them should be understood in the light of their teaching. But when we seek to bend 1 Corinthians to fit Matthew 19, we reverse the principle of interpretation. Besides, the two passages deal with the different angles of the matter. Jesus speaks of the man who should put away his wife for other reasons than adultery. Paul speaks of a man or woman who has been forsaken by the wife or the husband. The man must not put away his wife and marry another except for fornication. But if an unbelieving husband or wife leaves the believer, what then? The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. As long as the unbeliever was content to dwell with the believer must not depart. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. To me, the language means that the brother or sister is as free as if he had never been married. What else can the passage mean? If we did not have our minds made up another way, the passage would mean to us just what it says. But a brother writes and says that this means that the brother or sister is not bound to live with the unbeliever who runs off. Indeed. That's what Brother Brewer would do. I've heard him do this. Try to imitate him. He says, but someone says, this means if the unbeliever leaves, the believer is not bound to live with him. Huh, strange language coming from inspiration. If he leaves her, she doesn't have to live with him. But that would imply that if both were believers and one ran away, the other would be bound to live with a runaway spouse. How would a person go about living with one who runs away? Let us not charge Paul with the folly of saying to the believer, you're not bound to live with the unbeliever. It would be too bad if the Lord did require a believer to live with a runaway spouse. He says, I can see I've opened up a whole new can of worms. But if anyone thinks that I'm alone, and then he quotes all the commentaries, but he said he made up his mind even before reading them. McKnight is good on that. Read McKnight. G.C. Brewer is good on it. Many others. I believe that 1 Corinthians 7 allows the Christian remarriage without assuming fornication on the part of the unbeliever. Now, you might assume it, but you don't have to. I know J.D. Thomas in his recent series says that the Lord is assuming it and just saving the wife the trouble of hiring a detective. But I do not believe that it's necessary to assume that Paul is assuming and that the desertion on the part of the charizza, the putting asunder on the part of the non-Christian, leaves the Christian free. Still fellowship you though, Brother Floyd.
Brother Floyd, after all that, you want to say something, especially maybe how would you put that together with Matthew 19:9, the one cause there, or anything you'd like to say on it, okay?
I don't have any problem at all, except that as two good friends were walking along one day, and they were talking about premillennialism, and one was explaining it to the other, and he said, "There's just one thing wrong with it," and he said, "It's not in the text." He said,
"I missed the last word."
He said, "It's not in the text." And I have no quarrel with Brother Kelsey, whatever. I just think it's not in the text. I don't see it in the text. And it's just a matter with me of what is in the text and whether it's in a text or not. Let me just try to say this again. In verse 13, the problem, verses 12 and 13, the problem is this, that comes out of this mixed marriage. And it is, will the unbeliever consent to live with the Christian? It says, if the brother has an unbelieving wife and she consents to live with him, there is a question about whether the pagan would consent to live with the Christian or not. Now, in 15 he says, if the unbeliever departs. Now, of course, I don't think that means if the unbeliever has run away, then the Christian is not under obligation to live with a person. It doesn't mean that. If the unbeliever is pressing for a separation, then granted. There is only one thing the Christian could do to prevent this separation, and what is that? And that is to give up his Christianity. Should he do that? No. The brother or sister has not been enslaved and is not now enslaved in such cases. That is a bondage to which no Christian has ever been subjected. There is no obligation for him to do that. That is, to give up his Christianity in order to maintain the marriage.
Okay, thank you. Another key question, it seems to me, is this one. It's related to one... What's the name of that book, Brother Whiteside? A commentary?
Reflections. It's a book put out by his daughters. They gathered all these items together over a long... came in the Advocate and put it in one book, sort of like the Guy Woods book and those...
It's entitled Reflections.
Reflections.
Whiteside.
Arranged by and published by his daughters. Denton, Texas. I can give you the address later.
Okay. This question, does repentance by those who are improperly married necessitate separation? Okay.
I would want to talk to each couple separately. There is not a general ruling that can be made forcing upon people. Too many things to consider to just give an overall out, just say everybody. Nope, I'd have to talk to them. No, our law doesn't judge a man until it first hear him. If you have one, if you have in mind, I want to talk to him. Or I'd want to answer it.
Okay, Brother Floyd, would you like to comment? This is such a vital issue, it seems to me.
Well, I told you about that dream I had already. I think Brother Kelsey, really and truly, he has made a statement that shows tremendous wisdom. Tremendous. And I think what we have to do is to hold the teaching of Christ, and we have to apply it with compassion. I don't mean compromise, but with compassion. And we really and truly, we need to hear the person. We really do. I think we do. I think it's a good answer. And I'd just like to let that answer stand.
Okay, this is to Brother Kelsey. You constantly refer to true marriage, in quotation marks, without defining it. Your definition may eliminate the need for any discussion of divorce, since you qualify by the word true. You'd like to comment on that?
I'm not sure I understand the question yet. Let's see.
Sort of a comment.
You constantly refer to true marriage without defining it. Your definition may eliminate the need for any discussion of divorce, since you qualify by the word true. True marriage, I'm talking about a scriptural marriage. True marriage would be scriptural marriage, where it would be both legal and scriptural. You think that's enough on that, brother? Now, I will say this, that I am a bit undecided on what it takes to constitute a true marriage. I would say first that there must be eligibility. Eligible to marry. In other words, somebody that hadn't been out divorcing and so forth. Eligibility. Secondly, there should be intention. Honest intention. Thirdly, commitment, each to the other. Now, here's what I'm struggling with. Something I've always believed, and I've been interviewing people here lately, one night after another. When do you think a couple is joined in the sight of God? I've gotten several different answers. I've always felt that the marriage was completed when consummated. That is, a sexual union. I don't know that I can prove that, and I know that it involves me in a bad dilemma. I believe that before the union is consummated, the woman is his wife, but they're not married. Well, Paul said over there in 1 Corinthians 7, you know, go back to your wife or stay unmarried. So there's a man that's unmarried and still has a wife. All right, so I know this. I played with a young lady years ago. She came to me crying and brokenhearted because she had married a fellow. And had the ceremony, everything, license. But they had not had union, physical union. And she said she could not bear to go through with it. She knew she didn't love him. She could not tolerate the thought of being married. But she was determined to go ahead with it anyway. Said they'd given her a shower and gifts and everything to embarrass too many people. I begged her not to go on with that marriage. I really pled with her not to go on with it. Now, I might have been wrong there. In my own mind, I feel that if I had been in her place, I would have felt less guilt in backing out at that point than I would have had the marriage been already consummated. I have always felt in the mind that that you could back out at any stage until after the consummation. But I said I'm not too sure on that. Not as sure as I would be if I were more sure, as Brother Hardman used to say. But I just say true marriage would mean one that meets all these qualifications and is scriptural. Brother Floyd, do you have anything on that? Do you have your minds made up on when they're married?
Thank you. This does get into a serious problem at times. I remember talking to a couple not too long ago, been married 8 months, and the marriage never had been consummated. So there are some practical problems here. Here is another question. Does the act of baptism transform a non-marriage, adulterous relationship into a pure, divinely recognized marriage? Okay. Brother Floyd, do you want that one?
Where is that question? Do you have it still?
Yes.
Right here. Does the act of baptism...
Oh, I see. You're taking this... He's taking this one from the bulletin. Well, what I would like to suggest is that he wait till this afternoon... and ask that question, and then he will find someone better prepared to answer that question. I started to comment this about the question: does the act of baptism transform a non-marriage, adulterous relationship into a pure, divinely recognized marriage? I was going to say that is what you would call a loaded question. I didn't realize at the time that was from the bulletin. No, I'd have to answer. No, there's no way I could answer that question yes. I don't know how anybody could answer that question yes or would answer yes. I don't know anybody that would answer that question yes, and I would not. No.
Thank you. We're not going to get to all these questions now. We'll give them to Dr. Hazelip, and if you don't get enough questions this afternoon, you keep working down through on these. We might take time for one other question here, and then we'll break for lunch. Brother Kelsey, this is to Brother Floyd, said that the New Testament never approves divorce without an accompanying right to marry again. Okay. Brother Kelsey.
Oh, right.
Does that sound like what you said? Brother Kelsey said that the New Testament never, or did you say people who lived during the New Testament era never approves divorce without an accompanying right to marry again?
That is true. I said something that amounts to that, right?
Okay. And to Brother Floyd, do you agree? If so, what about 1 Corinthians 7:11 and 1 Corinthians 7:15?
Let's see now. The New Testament never approves divorce without an accompanying right to marry again. Do you agree? If so, what about 1 Corinthians 7:11 and 1 Corinthians 7:15? Yes, I think 1 Corinthians 7:11 is talking about a separation does not mean remarriage. As a matter of fact, the remarriage is prohibited in 1 Corinthians 7:11. Now, Paul says it is not desirable. The separation itself is not desirable. But even if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or let her be reconciled to her husband, 1 Corinthians 7:15, in my understanding, also refers to a separation in which the text does not mention remarriage and does not contemplate remarriage.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate so much, especially the spirit of the people who have participated here this morning, and although some disagreements, the spirit was just tremendous. We still have 31 tickets that Glenn of Grimes has for the luncheon at in the new building at the graduate school. He'll sell those to you on the way out. And is Dal here, a brother? Okay, would you come forward just a second? Dal teaches Greek at Fried Hartman College. We work together quite a bit in meetings and other ways, and appreciate him so much. And brought a couple of loads down for Fried Hartman today. Are several people, a couple of classes, and several others came also from Fried Hartman. I'd like for Dal to lead us in a word of closing prayer as we stand before we leave.